Welcome to this one-hour panel discussion on per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, commonly known as PFAS, here on WXPR. I'm Ben Meyer, along with Ken Krall, and we're joined by a number of panelists, experts in their field, who we'll introduce in just a moment. Over the past several months, chemical contaminants called PFAS have become a concern for many people in the Northwoods, especially in the greater Rhinelander area. These compounds were found in relatively high concentrations in a Rhinelander municipal water well, as well as in the popular town of Crescent Spring on South River Road near Rhinelander. Let's introduce you to PFAS a little bit. This is a group of man-made chemicals that for years was found in nonstick cookware, fast food wrappers, stain-resistant sprays, and certain types of firefighting foam, as well as other products. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, research suggests that high levels of certain PFAS may increase cholesterol levels, decrease how well the body responds to vaccines, increase the risk of thyroid disease, decrease fertility in women, and lead to low infant birth weights. On June 24th, the city of Rhinelander shut down Municipal Well 7, which is located at the Rhinelander-Oneida County Airport. That day, the city had reviewed testing data that showed water from the well had a PFAS concentration of 104.8 parts per trillion, above the recommended levels set by the EPA and the state of Wisconsin. The city informed residents of the shutdown on July 22nd, saying city water was safe to drink, as it was only pulling water from the city's other wells, which had tested below the recommended PFAS threshold. That same day, the Oneida County Health Department recommended against drinking from the popular Crescent Spring, a public water source on South River Road, while testing was conducted for PFAS. In mid-August, the Health Department strengthened that recommendations as tests came back with high levels of PFHXS, a compound in the PFAS family. On August 23rd, Governor Tony Evers signed Executive Order 40 on PFAS, directing the state to create a PFAS coordinating council, establish a public information website, expand PFAS monitoring, and set regulatory standards for groundwater and surface water. So with that backdrop, let's welcome our panelists, and I'll ask each to introduce himself, his job, and his connection to PFAS issues, and I'll start to my left with Kyle.
Thank you, Ben. My name is Kyle Burton. I'm the Field Operations Director with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Drinking and Groundwater. I'm part of a team of DNR employees and officials that work on PFAS-related issues, and as part of the Drinking and Groundwater program, I tend to focus on issues where public or private water supplies have been impacted with PFAS.
Thank you. Bart, go ahead.
Bart Sexton, soil scientist with Sand Creek Consultants. We're an environmental consulting company with offices in Rhinelander and Amherst, and we specialize in environmental investigations and remediation.
Ken Krall, WXPR News Director, is also with us. We'll be hearing from him throughout the day. And let's go to Todd.
Todd Trosky, Oneida County Health Department, registered environmental health specialist. I also have experience in the private sector as a hydrogeologist. And so the director of the health department, because of this issue, thought I would be a good fit to help the health department through the process.
And RT.
I'm RT Kruger. I'm the president of Northern Lakes Service. We're a private environmental compliance laboratory in Crandon. We've been involved in the testing for these compounds, primarily in drinking water across the country since about 2012. And we have been involved in some of the analytical work that's locally here in Rhinelander.
And a note about myself, I'm Ben Meyer at WXPR, and I'm a special topics correspondent working specifically on water and water resource issues through our ongoing series called The Stream. I'll also note that Rhinelander City Administrator Daniel Guild and Rhinelander Mayor Chris Fredrickson were invited to this forum, but were unable to attend. So a note for our listeners, we're looking for this to be a rather free-flowing and open discussion. We have a number of questions that we want to ask to bring you more information, but we're looking for our panelists and for our experts to share their knowledge in kind of a free-flowing discussion format. So the first question is going to start, I'm going to start with Bart, but I would like anyone that would like to add on to jump in. The first question is simply, what is PFAS, Bart, and how can you describe this family of chemicals to a regular person, for a regular person to kind of understand?
PFAS is, as you mentioned, are a group of man-made chemicals, and we're going to be learning for years all the different chemicals that are in this family. And they, as you mentioned, are included in a number of products. Right now, we're kind of concentrating on the known gross contaminations, if you will. So AFFF, or aqueous firefighting foam, is a product that was commonly and is still used for fighting fires, and that has definitely been linked to PFAS contamination in groundwater and in soils. Also, metal plating operations, they often used a spray that contained PFAS in it. And ironically, the spray was there to contain the metal ion so that workers didn't ingest it. But as a result, they've been exposed to PFAS, and there were some possible releases from there. And then you have manufacturers of all of the products that you've mentioned, things as firefighting foam all the way to ski wax, cosmetics, paper wrappers. They all included PFAS, so manufacturers are places where those chemicals would have been concentrated, used, perhaps spilled, perhaps not even spilled, but just released as a regular part of the manufacturing process. And a big part of what we're trying to understand are, first, where all the sources are. So we don't fully understand where all of these potential sources are, and that's part of the work that's going on right now as we discover them in drinking water. And then once we discover the sources, trying to decide what the, or not decide, but find out what the fate of these chemicals are in the environment. And that's a big part of how it gets to groundwater. You have interactions with the organic matter in the soil, with the soil particles itself, with the groundwater, and how the groundwater is moving. Those are all characteristics that are going to impact if PFAS gets in the water, what form of PFAS will get in the water, and how far that contamination may move in the groundwater.
RT, you do testing for PFAS at your lab, among many other contaminants in water. We're talking something in a range of 4,000 known compounds that are in this PFAS family, right? And tests are out there for comparatively a small handful of them. Am I getting that right, more or less?
That's correct. A lot of the testing that has historically been done for environmental compliance are methodologies that have been around for a long time, and this is a case where the science is staying just barely a step ahead of the need for more information. The primary method that we've used has only been around since about 2009. It has been used extensively, and it works well for, as you said, Ben, for a relatively small number of these compounds. Initially, I believe that method was developed for about a dozen compounds. It was recently revised to include about 18 compounds. A number of states and other agencies have added up to 25, 36 compounds. But again, we're talking still about a very small portion of the number of compounds that might be out there. That also, I guess, leads us to, I guess, what I would call a bit of necessary caution in trying to apply these methods to compounds that are like one another in ways, but may not cooperate quite as well with the method as it was developed.
I want to turn to the next question, first to Todd, and maybe Kyle can add in on this as well. In a basic sense, Todd, why should we be concerned in this area or anywhere else? Why should we be concerned about PFAS getting into our bodies through drinking water? And what do we know about potential health impacts at this point?
Well, there's definitely been some links to certain health conditions, high blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and potential birth defects. So, you know, we are concerned about that. And because of the fact that a majority of the people in the county get their water from their own private wells, you know, that's really an issue, because we're assuming that because we have such great water in general, that we're not going to have any issues in our own private wells. But, you know, moving forward, we're just going to want to be sure that if there is some some responsible party that's been established, that we make sure that well owners are aware that they may need to do their own sampling to make sure that they don't have any PFAS in their drinking water.
Kyle, would you like to add on to that? Why should we be concerned? Why should anybody be concerned about potential PFAS contamination in water generally?
Well, ingestion is the main pathway for people to be exposed to PFAS, and ingestion of drinking water with high content of PFAS is we're seeing the most common and the most dangerous way for folks to be exposed to PFAS. People can be exposed to PFAS in many ways. Bart was saying, it's kind of ubiquitous in our lives. It's on nonstick food contact surfaces like Teflon. It's part of stain repellents for carpets and clothing, water resistant clothing. All of that contains PFAS. So we're exposed to it in many ways, but the highest way we're exposed to it is through ingestion of contaminated food, and I think more so drinking water with high levels of PFAS in it.
Another point is that at least some of these compounds are known or thought to be bioaccumulators, correct?
Correct.
In other words, that just because you intake it doesn't mean it's going to pass through your system right away. Some of these will build up in concentrations over time.
I think it's also important to recognize, though, that strictly speaking, there have only been health advisories set for two of these compounds, and they seem to be the most prevalent, but they are not by any means the only ones that we're finding with some frequency. And that adds, to me, it adds significantly to some of the confusion over these things, is not having that information available. And I know that that Michigan has worked with some toxicologists to try to establish some additional health standards based on science, and I'm using air quotes there, because to be honest, there seems to be, even though these have been recognized for a number of years, there doesn't seem to be the health science out there. At least it's not easily obtainable and easy to evaluate in order to set these things up. Some of these standards that have come through this team of toxicologists are very similar to the ones that have been set already, the 70 parts per trillion, give or take. But others are literally tens of thousands of times higher based on the statistical information that's available from the limited health studies. So that's obviously a big part of this moving forward, is getting more of that, establishing more of that information so that we can make some wise decisions as to what really is the relevance of these things.
Go ahead, Ken.
Question for anyone. I'd like to just let people know how little or how much of this pollutes a body of water. I don't know who wants to take that, but Bart, maybe. I know it doesn't take very much from what I'm told.
No, you start to talk about, when we're talking, currently Wisconsin has a standard, not standard, but
a recommendation
of 20 parts per trillion for the two best known PFAS compounds, which are PFOA, P-F-O-A, and PFOS, P-F-O-S. And that's 20 parts per trillion, as I understand, is a couple drops in an Olympic-sized swimming pool is roughly the analogy you can give for to understand. In comparison, when we were talking about things like PCBs, oftentimes we were talking in parts per million. Well, one part per million compared to one part per trillion, 1 million of a millionth is a trillion. So understanding we're talking six orders of magnitude lower concentrations than we were with some of these earlier contaminants that we commonly dealt with and still do.
RT, your lab in Crandon is one of a very few that has the technology to do some of this testing for these tiny concentrations that Bart was talking about. The EPA recommended level is 70 parts per trillion or below for PFAS. The state recommended level, as Bart mentioned, is 20 parts per trillion. When I visited you before, you described it as extremely difficult and extremely expensive to test for PFAS. Tell me a little bit about that process and what makes it so difficult.
Well, we are talking about extremely low levels, and one of the things that I'd kind of like to interject right now is that there are some fears about cross-contamination, and that's another complexity of this, but we have also found that if you use some reasonable collection techniques, some reasonably wise collection techniques, and good lab practices, that you can avoid those kind of things. But it is very, these are very sensitive and extremely low levels. The process itself is basically two steps. You have to be able to, you have a process that grabs onto these compounds that literally chemically bonds with them so that you can remove the water from the sample. Believe it or not, you're collecting a water sample, but the water is an interferent in the analysis. And so you have to chemically bond with those things, grab onto the compounds of interest, and then remove the water. And then you inject that into machinery that will separate the compounds based on their attraction or repulsion to another liquid. That's the way that you separate them, and then you're bombarding those ionic particles. You're bombarding them with other ions to break them apart to be able to measure them in these extremely, extremely low concentrations. So even though we are talking about low levels, the instrumentation, and again, if you're looking at the compounds that the methods were developed for, the instrumentation is very, very good at doing it. But again, it's expensive. They're $250,000 pieces of equipment. So it's a big step for a laboratory to decide to do this, to go through the validation processes. As regulatory agencies add compounds to these, each of those compounds needs to be individually validated. One of the biggest difficulties for anybody doing this is even getting the materials, the raw materials, to be able to calibrate the instrumentation and validate them. If you are looking for compound XYZ, we have to be able to buy compound XYZ, and we have to be able to buy it from two sources so we can check one against the other. So it's a very, very complex and expensive process.
You're listening to a special panel discussion between four experts on PFAS, brought to you by WXPR. You just heard from R.T. Kruger, the president of Northern Lake Service, a water testing facility in Crandon. We're also speaking with Bart Sexton, a professional soil scientist at Sand Creek Consultants here in Rhinelander. Kyle Burton, a DNR drinking water and groundwater field operations director. And Todd Trosky, an environmental health specialist from the Oneida County Health Department. As part of this forum, we asked our listeners what questions they might have about PFAS. And I'd like to share one of them that submitted a question via our Curious North series on WXPR.org. And this is for anybody, and it's kind of a tricky question. The question is, how long has PFAS been in the water in Rhinelander, and where or what is its source? And how long does it remain? So it's a tricky question, and I'll let anyone take a stab at it.
Well, the answer, I think the answer is we don't know how long it's been in the water. We have sample results that stem from 2013. In 2013, Rhinelander was part of a project run by the EPA, and that had some sampling done around the country for municipalities with populations of 10,000 and above. During that time, Rhinelander did have detects of PFAS compounds. And at that time, the health levels were set at a different level than they are now. In 2012, 2013, when the sample results came in, the health levels for PFOA and PFOS were in the hundreds. And in 2016, EPA furthered the science and lowered those health advisory levels to 70 in 2017, 16 and 17. And it was at that point that the Department of Natural Resources started to reach out to the city of Rhinelander and ask them if they wanted to maybe do some more investigative work to take some more samples and find out what levels are. Because the other things that happens in that time period was that analytical levels methods had changed. We were able to determine that smaller amounts were present in the drinking water. So with better analytical methods and lower health advisory levels, we, being the Department of Natural Resources, engaged with the city of Rhinelander and other places around the state that had detects in that initial EPA monitoring to maybe do some more investigative monitoring determine the levels that are present, and then, you know, take actions like the city of Rhinelander voluntarily did in the event that elevated levels were found in their drinking water system.
Ben, can I add something? I'd like to clarify the program that Kyle just alluded to is called UCMR. It's unregulated contaminant monitoring requirement. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that's not something that was initiated by Rhinelander or any of the other entities that do the testing. This is a program that EPA runs on about a 7-year cycle to look at things that are not currently regulated to try to measure frequencies and levels out in the environment to determine if they should be regulated. And so it's important for people to understand that this is an information gathering activity. There are not compliance levels at that point. So it's a situation where entities that do this testing they frankly don't get a lot of information as far as what the next step should be. They're basically in a holding pattern until the EPA directs them on what the relevance of finding those things are. I think, again, that's important for people to understand if they're concerned about that period of time from when they were first detected to now, that it wasn't anything that people were not using that information or taking any sort of steps. It was a process of determining what the appropriate steps were, getting that information from EPA to DNR, to the municipalities, to whoever found these things. So it's a good program. It's an important program. And pretty infrequently, we have a situation where we find any of these unregulated compounds in frequencies that make follow-up as big of a deal as it has been for PFAS.
I think in terms of the sources, that's the million-dollar question, or perhaps multi-million-dollar question, and we're just at the beginning of the process. DNR, R&R is starting to look at manufacturers in the area, has questionnaires out. There's a lot of hydrogeology that needs to be done. And as we've mentioned a couple times already, just the variety of products and substances that contain these, it's often not the primary product, but it's an addition to that product. There's a lot of potential sources for it. So it's something we called, right now we've got a lot of data gaps on this. We know a little, we know we've got it, but trying to determine a source or sources, and you have to keep that in mind, it may not just be one source in this case. It's going to take some investigative work to do that, and you may never be able to definitively say it's source X or source X and Y. You can do guesstimations, pretty much, or scientific guesses, I guess, would be a better way to say it. But people need to keep in mind that we're still working when we talk about investigation, as an example, the methods that we're talking about for testing, it's really only for drinking water. We don't have any tests for wastewater. We don't have any tests for landfill leachate, which is water that's coming out of landfills. There are tests for soils, but again, we're at a much higher concentration than what we can look for in drinking water. So we've got one media that we're beginning to get confident on that data that we're receiving from it. And it's going to be quite some time here yet before we get these other media to a testing regime that everybody agrees upon is the best scientific way of doing it. And that's a lot of our quandary here is our team mentioned, not getting the cart in front of the horse here, because we can spend a lot of time and a lot of money even just looking at stuff or looking for stuff, let alone getting to remediation, which we're barely starting baby steps on that, other than some water filtration methodologies that are out there. We need to base that on good data, any decisions we make in the future, because we can, like I say, we can spend a lot of money and then find out 10 years later that was largely wasted because it's not as high a priority as we thought it was.
Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, and just to add to what Kyle was talking about in terms of we don't really know how long the PFAS contamination has been in the area, that's the exact reason why the health department wanted to test the Crescent Spring, knowing that the spring was within just over a mile away from the Rhinelander number 7 well. And of course, we don't know at this point what the groundwater flow direction is. We've got an idea of what it might be, but we don't know for sure. And we don't know how fast the groundwater might be flowing, because we might have interactions between glacial geology and bedrock. And so to protect public health, because so many people get their drinking water from the Crescent Spring, we thought it was a good idea to be on the forefront of you know, collecting the sample right away and getting that information out to the public.
Thanks. So I my next question, I'm going to first direct at Kyle. I think a lot of people might be surprised to learn that, for as much as PFAS has been in conversations, that currently there are no federal or state enforceable regulations as it relates to PFAS as a contaminant in water, like there are for so many other contaminants in water. Describe why that is right now, why there's nothing enforceable, and where we are in that process of making an enforceable standard.
You know, for us in Wisconsin, this is a new issue. You know, it's called an emerging contaminant for a reason, because it's an emerging issue. RT referenced that we're still learning a lot about this compound. Not a lot is known. We're not getting in normal contamination, emerging contamination processes. The federal government will take the lead. They will set first health advisory levels, and then they will determine through the unregulated monitoring rule, they'll determine that yes, there should be a maximum contaminant level set, and that direction will come from the federal government. So we, with the Department of Natural Resources, we enforce the Safe Drinking Water Act, and that's where a lot of the or all for the state of Wisconsin right now, that's where all of the maximum contaminant levels are drawn from. And in this case, the science and the information about these contaminants are way ahead of the regulation. So, and there's differing sciences coming from differing sources. So there really isn't an accepted level. Many other states around the nation are dealing with this level. They're setting their own enforceable levels. And they vary from things that are higher than 70, the federal health advisory limit, to things that are much lower. States on the East Coast, states on the West Coast, Colorado, Texas, California are all addressing this on their own. So there's a variable kind of landscape out there. In the state of Wisconsin, we've decided to move forward and use the science that's available to us to make some of the determinations on what standards might be the most appropriate. We asked in 2017 or 18, we asked our Department of Health Services to give us a health-based recommendation on a groundwater standard, which is a groundwater standard is set and it's normally used or usually used for cleanup methods, for when there's a remediation case or when they're cleaning up contamination, they want to return the groundwater to below that standard. And the standard that they came to us with is that 20 parts per trillion combined, or combined of the PFOA and the PFOS.
And now, if I understand right, sorry, RT, we'll get to you in just a second. Now the Department of Natural Resources is working on making that an enforceable standard. Do I understand that?
Correct. You referenced at the outset that the governor signed an executive order asking us to begin the rulemaking process to create enforceable standards for not only drinking water, but surface water and the groundwater standard that I talked about. So we're currently in the first steps of the rulemaking process. We've created what's called a scope statement, which is basically outlines what we'd like to do, what the rule might look like. Our next steps, that scope statement is signed by the governor. Our next step is to go to our Natural Resources Board and petition to be able to have a public hearing on that scope statement. During that public hearing, the public and other interest groups will have the opportunity to weigh in. Public comment and transparency is very important to us through the entire rulemaking process. our rulemaking process does take a long time. There's a lot of public input pieces built into that, legislative input pieces built into that, which is why it takes a long time. So it takes up towards 30 months for us to promulgate a rule.
That's Kyle Burton from the Wisconsin DNR, and I cut off R.T. Kruger from Northern Lake Service, who was about to make a comment.
Well, I don't want to get too far into the weeds from an analytical standpoint, but one of the other complexities here is if we start talking about advisory limits that are around 20, in some states they've gone down around 10s and 15s, we're talking about a number of different compounds here, and we are talking about approaching the limits of those technologies. And so if our instrumentation is able to see down to approximately 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 parts per trillion, that's an area of less certainty on the exact amounts. We know something's there, but there's less certainty. If you start to add up those tiny amounts of less certainty, you can exceed those advisory limits with a bunch of pieces of data that, I don't want to make people think these methods are no good, but we have to be very, very careful when we're down at those levels to be adding those things up and exceeding advisory limits and basing remediation or compliance decisions on those kind of pieces of data. So just some additional complexity for the regulators to have to juggle in order to come up with some of these levels. And
I think a point on the federal 70, and Kyle can probably correct me if I'm wrong here, but that was more a screening level is the way it was developed. In other words, if you had PFOA and PFOS at a combined concentration of 70 parts per trillion, that was like a warning flag and you should look more into it was where they're at. What we're right now, the feds, the EPA has a PFAS action plan. They're beginning down that path, but that's an even longer path than states. But what is, and going to your question from the listener, is that so what's going to happen? What's going to, people want to know. And it's going to take a while. We have to have patience on this, both with the testing methodology, but then also in the rulemaking process. That's the nature of the beast, but there's a reason for that. Part of what we're seeing now with all the states developing different standards, somebody asked, well, why in this state is it 10 parts per trillion and in this state it's 200 parts per trillion, and the people at 200 parts per trillion, are we less susceptible to PFAS or what? Risk assessment is a model. They are models, and what you input to that model is going to impact your output. So some people are going to bias more from what they see as a safety standpoint, some more from what is actually out in the environment standpoint, and some are going to be in between. So that's why you're going to get, even if states use the same models to derive their risk assessments, what they determine as being pertinent information or data to input is going to impact what they get out for a number. Everybody wants to try and protect the public. There's no disagreement on that, but there, if you've ever been involved in literature review with science, there's always going to be debate. And so that's why you see this range of values. Some of it is scientific debate and some of it is political. And when we get into the rulemaking process, unfortunately, the political side of that equation does come in.
And the next question comes from WXPR News Director Ken Kroll.
I have a question. We've been talking about this issue as if it's a relatively new thing. Does anybody have an idea how long these chemicals have been in the environment? We're just discovering now, but how long have they been around?
Second World War, 1930s, 40s?
1930s, 40s, yep.
And they've evolved. That's why we end up with 4,000 of them, is not only that they're used in so many different products and processes, but also that companies have been kind of chasing each other in the manufacture of these. They've been used, and then somebody finds something that's a tiny bit different that works a little bit better, and then somebody finds something that's a tiny bit different that works in this other industry. And so they began about that time period, but they have evolved just constantly over the past 70 years.
And then that's been accelerated in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when people started to have questions about
PFOA and PFOS. And Minnesota has done a lot of work on this because one of the main manufacturers was 3M.
The next question is for Kyle from the DNR, and anyone else who would like to chime in as well. But describe the DNR process after there's a considerable PFAS detect, like we had in Rhinelander, like we had at Municipal Well 7. How does a DNR investigation work to figure out what might be the source or sources from there?
Well, when any groundwater contamination is detected, the department's remediation bureau will take an inventory of the surrounding industries and land users. They'll send out letters or questionnaires, like was referenced earlier, asking potential responsible parties for information about their use and disposal of the compounds in question. Based on the responses they receive from those questionnaires, they may begin working with one or more responsible parties to begin a full investigation and remediation of the contamination.
Todd, what role does the Oneida County Health Department have in that ongoing investigation and ongoing public information campaign to make sure people know where we stand?
Yeah, so the health department's main objective is to make sure that people are aware of what's going on. So we're in the business of educating in part, and so what the health department has done is been able to get, using our website, our Facebook, get information out there in terms of what people need to know about PFAS, whether they need to consider sampling their well, keeping the public apprised of what's going on with additional testing, not only in the city, but if there's additional testing on the Crescent Spring as well. And so we're just really looking to make sure at this point, working with the DNR and working with the city, to provide as much information to the public as we can so that they're informed.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah,
yes.
I just want to piggyback on what Todd was saying about advice that we give municipalities and individuals when PFAS is detected in drinking water. You know, we advise municipalities who have, you know, voluntary sampled for PFAS to share information with their customers. So if you're going to sample for it, we ask them to share that information, those results, with the customers. And when those levels of PFAS are found above federal or state recommended standards, we work with those municipalities to issue a public notice like we did here in Rhinelander. That was, again, voluntarily done by the city of Rhinelander. Those notices will include all the health information. We want to make sure the folks that are consuming this water have the information they need to make a decision based on what they want to do with their own drinking water. And, you know, if those elevated levels persist, you know, if levels over those standards persist in the drinking water, the notice would offer advice on what parts of the population are most susceptible to that contamination. This is work that we do with the Department of Health. You know, so if there's a portion of the population that should not drink the water because of, you know, the more susceptible population should not drink it, we would include that information in the public notice. And when it comes, like Todd was talking about, with people with private wells, you know, our message is essentially the same. We would lean on the advice given by the local and state Department of Health to the well owners. It's important to note that private wells, the quality of wells outside of a groundwater investigation, it's not a regulated piece. You know, we with the state of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources don't regulate private water quality. So our authority is limited when it comes to their operation. But what we do recommend for folks with private wells, if they're concerned about the quality of their drinking water in the private well, that they get it sampled. If they have questions about those results, they contact us or the Department of Health, and we'll be able to give them advice on how to move forward.
RT.
I'd like to add something off of what Kyle's just said. It's important, a little bit of consumer advice here. There are tests that we've seen advertised for that talk about a less expensive alternative that are in the $100 range. That when you look closely have detection limits that are about 10,000 times the advisory limits. So if you are concerned about this, I guess I'd advise that you do talk to your county health departments or a DNR rep or somebody, some authority that will help you find an appropriate testing facility for that.
Along with that, too, the importance of proper sampling. If our team mentioned, it's perhaps not as it's different than regular volatile organic chemical sampling. There's different things you have to look for. But again, the important thing about sampling is doing it methodically and the same each and every time. And if the public just goes out and grabs a sample without particular attention to what they're wearing, what their sample's being collected in, how they've run the water or not run the water beforehand, those are all important things that could impact the result. And if you want, these tests are expensive, if you want to have them run, I would recommend you probably at least talk to a professional on how to do it, or the lab, before you go taking a sample. Otherwise, you may get data and you really don't know what it means.
I want to ask a question. I'll start with Kyle, because as I understand, he has statewide responsibilities with DNR. We've been talking mostly about PFAS here in the Rhinelander area, and for our listeners, that's obviously an area of focus. Give us a sense of how widespread positive or elevated levels of detects of PFAS in different drinking water samples are across the state. Is Rhinelander an outlier, or are there quite a few instances that are similar? If you can speak to that.
I can. We're dealing with, first I'll go back to the unregulated contaminant monitoring. There were detects in three other municipalities, or two or three other municipalities around the state, and they're in different corners of the state, south part of the state, western part of the state, northern part of the state. Also, we're dealing with PFAS-related contamination issues. Right now, we have a very large-scale one in the northeast part of the state, in Marinette County. Right. We're also dealing with situations in Madison. Madison has been doing some, the Madison area has been doing some PFAS work. We're working with other potential contamination cases or remediation cases in all over the state. So I would not say that Rhinelander is an outlier. I would say it's part of an emerging, a growing group of contamination sites around the state of Wisconsin.
Ken, go ahead.
No, I just had a question here from Curious North. Has anyone ever looked to see if there were higher rates of cancer, infertility rates among those who grew up in Rhinelander that could be linked to PFAS in the water? Todd?
Well, that's been a little bit of a discussion on our end, and I guess it's just tough to, you know, to get certain groups together and to try to sort through that data. It would be, you know, it'd be really difficult at this point to try to determine what those effects might be and to tie one, you know, put one and one together on that end. So, and I guess I'm not really aware at this point if that's been done, you know, in any other state that's had significant PFAS issues like Minnesota.
Would it be fair to say, Todd, that even if there were a certain, even if there were to be found a higher level of a certain health impact or a certain health malady, it'd be difficult to tie it to a specific source like PFAS with any level of certainty? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I would say that's very fair. It's, you know, when people are exposed to all different kinds of things throughout their life, from birth to death, and it's just very difficult to try to determine, you know, based on, you know, mortality rates and where people live and, you know, what kind of lifestyle they led. It's just very difficult to pinpoint where, you know, one person's cancer might be coming from or health issues might be coming from compared to some other thing that they may have been exposed to in the past.
So the good question that you heard is difficult to answer. That was a question that was from one of our listeners through WXPR's Curious North program. Bart, go ahead.
The other thing, too, keep in mind that, again, the variety of chemicals. So you do not want to lump PFAS altogether, because even on the EPA's website, when they list out things that they believe are associated with chemical, if you compare PFOA with PFOS, there are different things that they believe are linked to each of those. And one has thyroid and one has a potential increased cancer risk. And now we start to get into the myriad, the next 33, and then the hundreds and then thousands after that. Add to that combinations of those chemicals or other chemicals in the drinking water, and everybody has a different susceptibility. as some people can take a higher dose and you won't have any impact. Some people could be at 1/100th of that dose and have a health impact as a result of that. So that's the complexity that Todd alludes to. That's an epidemiology study unto itself, but you'd have to look at each compound individually, at least just to begin with. That's just the beginning.
You just heard the voice of Bart Sexton, a professional soil scientist with Sand Creek Consultants. We're a little more than 45 minutes into our hour-long panel discussion on PFAS, a water contaminant here in Rhinelander. Also joined by R.T. Kruger, the president of Northern Lake Service in Crandon, Todd Trosky, an environmental health specialist at the Oneida County Health Department, and Kyle Burton, the DNR Drinking and Groundwater Field Operations Director. I'm going to direct my next question to Bart again. I think it's easy to come up with theories on what might be a source. And there's a lot of topics and theories that run around in conversations around the Rhinelander area. A couple of popular theories about potential contaminants that you and I have talked about is this AFFF, aqueous firefighting foam, that is used at the Rhinelander Oneida County Airport in small amounts, 2 to 4 gallons per year as part of FAA-mandated tests. But again, the well that was contaminated was there at the airport, and we know this firefighting foam is a known source of PFAS. You told me before that even in a small amount couldn't be ruled out as a potential contaminant for well 7. Tell me more about why you say that.
Sure, if we look at an application of 2 to 4 gallons a year, and there's some questions, what percent of that product is active ingredient or PFAS? Mm-hmm. Is it 100%? Is it 5%? Is it 1%? It has an impact. But if it's 100%, 2 gallons, again, we're talking, if we're looking at a 20 part per trillion action level potentially for an enforcement standard, we're talking hundreds or tens to hundreds of billions of gallons of water that could be impacted by that if it all went down to groundwater. As I mentioned earlier, there's going to be retarding factors to that, how it moves through the soil, what form is that chemical or compounds are in, and some of these will vary. When RT talks about getting things ionized, then they become mobile in the environment if they are anionic or negatively charged. If they're neutral or positively charged, the soil will tend to hold them more. The point being that, in the bigger discussion here, that a big part of environmental investigations is one, identifying sources. Where's it coming from? Because stuff in the groundwater, those are horses out of the barn already. And the question is, where's the barn? Is there going to be more horses coming out? And then two, potential receptors. And that's where Todd talked about defining groundwater direction, speed of groundwater movement, impacts that the well pumping may have on that groundwater movement. There's a lot of questions in there. There's years of work just trying to define that just for the area around the airport and the Crescent Spring.
Anyone else on that?
Well, I guess I just wanted to add that I feel like real troubleshooting, real problem solving requires some speculation, but we also live at a period of time where we all have to be really, really careful speculating, again, because of the political angles of some of these things. And that, again, adds to the difficulty in some of this stuff, because you'd like to sit in a room with people and really brainstorm about what all of the potential sources might be and the potential impacts might be, but we all have to be cognizant of something that we say in that problem-solving mode might be taken outside of the room and used in a different manner. So I just think that's another point of being cautious in the whole process. And
I think you'd say that about a lot of things, and so people, I've already had people pull things up on the internet and say, well, look at this. And like, well, it's not a scientifically reviewed paper. Just because, if you don't know this already, folks, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true.
Ken Krall, WXPR News Director, has our next question.
Heard this come up earlier, but we didn't talk too much about it. Is there anything you can do to remediate this stuff, or is it too soon to know?
Well, the main thing is probably carbon and different resin filters that are currently used to treat drinking water. So it's relatively clean water that you're taking in. But where we're running into issues is wastewater, and landfill leachate is another form of wastewater. Because the organic matrices or the organic particles in those waste streams tend to hold some of those particles and make them less available to be pulled out or remediated. So we're really, the EPA is throwing out a bunch of money right now for potential technologies to address it, but it's all theoretical right now, and they're trying to just get bench scale stuff proven and then upscale that to larger applications. So to answer your question, it's really just filters for drinking water, to my knowledge.
Yeah, and that's right where I was going to go. I mean, remediation and treatment, I think, are two different things. Remediation refers to cleaning up contamination, getting it out of the environment. Where like Bart was saying, there's not a lot of good science on that yet. But where we are finding success is treating drinking water. When it comes to contaminated drinking water, the department's first recommendation for folks is always to try to find an alternative safe source. So can you get your drinking water from a different place that does not have PFAS? So can you construct a new well in a manner where it's getting water from somewhere else that doesn't have PFAS in it? That's sometimes a possibility. Can you connect to a different source where the PFAS water, it doesn't have elevated levels? Or can you eliminate, like Rhinelander did, a source of PFAS? They turned off well 7, which was the contaminated wells. They continued to sample their other wells. They continued to provide water to the customers that does not have elevated levels of PFAS. Around the country, not in Wisconsin, but around the country, there are municipalities that have had PFAS-contaminated water. There are municipalities that are treating for PFAS-contaminated water. There are tested treatments that do work. They include, Bart referred to, carbon, granulated activated carbon systems for municipalities have been constructed around the country and are working. There is anion exchange works, which is kind of a softening type system, and also RO and nanofiltration or other types of treatment technologies that do remove these PFAS compounds. On the private water side, if folks want to treat a private water well, we are using the responsible parties in other contamination cases around the state are supplying whole home granulated activated carbon systems and monitoring those. That is removing PFAS from drinking water. There has been some science, some testing out of Minnesota that these carbon filters that attach to faucets do have some success when used to manufacturers, when used and maintained to manufacturer standards, can remove PFAS standards. Again, that's comes from the Minnesota Health Department, not something that we would, not something that we're endorsing. We're not endorsing any product here, but I just want to give people the information that they need or that they can use to protect themselves if they so wish.
And there is a link on the Oneida County Health Department's website to the Minnesota resource that Kyle was talking about to look up for well owners to look up what carbon filter they might be able to install if they did have an issue. So that resource is out there on the Oneida County website.
The final question I want to ask is something that if all of you are able to answer, I'd love to hear your opinion. And I think it's the central question in a lot of listeners' minds, that when they turn on their tap, they wonder if their water is safe to drink. So in your opinion, should people in the Rhinelander area feel safe drinking their water right now, whether it's in the city of Rhinelander or in the surrounding area? I'd like you to answer that to the best of your ability, and we can start with Kyle.
Sure. Within the city of Rhinelander, the city does continue to voluntarily monitor their wells and their distribution system on a monthly basis. The water that they're serving to the customers does not have PFAS over any recommended state or federal standards, the state of Wisconsin or federal standards. Our recommendation to private well owners around the Rhinelander area is if they're concerned about the quality of their drinking water, they should get it sampled. They should contact a lab like RT's or the State Lab of Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene that can sample for these. There are other labs outside of the state that can sample for PFAS compounds. But if they're concerned about the quality of their water as related to PFAS or any other contaminants, they should get it sampled. And when they get those results, the Department of the local Department of Health or the Department of Natural Resources can help people determine what those results mean.
Bart, should people feel safe drinking their water in the Rhinelander area?
I think generally, yes, with the caveat, again, what's around you. And so if you're around the area of the airport and you have a private well, there may be an issue. We don't know exactly because we don't know the extent. Otherwise, if you're out in the country, you have less of a concern. If you're closer to a manufacturer and you're not really sure what they're doing, it might be a concern. So we've got a, how's that for a sliding?
I thought the RT was black trying and white to get away from the political consideration. Political answer.
But
go ahead.
It's areas of gray. So generally I would say in terms of, like Kyle said, City of Rhinelander is being very proactive on this and they're doing a good job of monitoring because they know they have an issue. Folks out in the country, if you are out and away and in the North Woods and sitting on the lake, you probably really don't have an issue, at least for PFAS that we know of. And most of the other folks, if you're getting closer to town or you're next to a manufacturing, most of those are into the city limits. So it's really not an issue that I would suspect.
Todd, same question.
Yeah, well, I think Bart probably needs to come work for us because that's pretty much what I was going to say other than I would hope that a majority of the private wells out there would not have any PFAS contamination in it. But like Bart was saying, we just don't know. Something recently that I saw, Minnesota is going to undertake some air monitoring now for PFAS as well. So that would add another layer to what we've been talking about in terms of, okay, just like the mercury issue with mercury getting into our lakes via the air route, is there the potential for PFAS to be distributed via air? And then how is that going to make its way into the groundwater? So that's going to be an up-and-coming study that I'll definitely be interested in hearing about.
One last quick thing is just that I think what we'll probably see in these outlying areas is probably just going to be changes in our plumbing components in the future. We use Teflon tape. There's Teflon-coated fixtures. There's how much of that comes off and at what concentration. We don't know. But as we go down lower and lower, we're talking parts per trillion. Someday it'll be parts per quadrillion and quintillion. And are we at those levels? I don't know.
You've been hearing the voices of Bart Sexton, a professional soil scientist at Sand Creek Consultants in Rhinelander and the former Oneida County Solid Waste Director, R.T. Kruger, the president of Northern Lake Service, a water testing facility in Crandon, Kyle Burton, the DNR Drinking and Groundwater Field Operations Director, and Todd Trosky, an environmental health specialist at the Oneida County Health Department. And you've also heard a questioner and a number of questions from Ken Krall, the WXPR News Director. I want to say thank you to our panelists and thank you to the listeners for joining this panel discussion on PFAS in the Rhinelander area. It's a topic sure to be of continued interest in the future. And for more reporting on water and water resources, I invite you to check out WXPR's The Stream, which airs Thursday at 6:45 a.m., 8:45 a.m., and 5:45 p.m. You can also submit your water-related questions to me at ben@wxpr.org or by visiting The Stream on wxpr.org. Thank you for joining us.